to inform you your request for a second love has been refused, and the board of directors up in the city has instructed us to take the farm from you. We understand your problems and wish that we could help you, but the falling price of wheat is not our concern, and the cost of operation may well be rising, but the fact is that you lose more than you earn.
They really were sleeping this time, literally. Because it was a late night session when Congress, the House of Representatives, approved the Central American Free Trade Agreement. What can we say about this, folks, that we haven't said in the past? I mean, this is bad for America. This is going to cause more and more jobs to be lost. Jobs are going to be lost to Central America now. I mean, only a government, only a criminal government of people who are controlled can take failed policies and expand upon them. I mean, it's not hard to see what this has done to America. This is the 29th of July, 2005. Welcome to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Two votes was the margin that Congress passed, the House of Representatives passed this thing. And I got a feeling there's some bullying that went on here, and we're going to get into that here in just a moment. I want to share with you a little bit from The Wire about this vote, and we're going to move on to some global warming news tonight, because we have other issues that are happening, other things are going on. This is a building block, of course, for the free trade area of the Americas. So much happening. This global plan, this plan for global domination by these people, whoever they are, whoever these socialists are, these closet communists, it moves forward at a very rapid pace. And that's why we have to try to expose all aspects of it. And unfortunately, this thing happened. But we cannot get discouraged. We cannot give up. We have a responsibility before God and before future generations to keep at this. Those of us who have the truth, who know the truth, it is incumbent upon all of us to do the right thing for the country and keep at it. Even if we had no chance of winning whatsoever, we still have a responsibility to try, because there is so much at stake. There is so much at stake in this fight. But I do believe we have a chance to win it. I believe this is a winnable war. But we have to have numbers. We have to wake up the population. From The Wire, we see CAFTA trade pact clears U.S. Congress. It says a free trade pact with Central America and the Dominican Republic cleared the U.S. Congress after it was approved by a narrow 217 to 215 vote in the House of Representatives. seems kind of funny how these trade pacts are always very narrow. I can recall the NAFTA vote, it only passed by one vote, and that was Al Gore breaking the tie. It was actually tied in Congress. And Gore came in and cast the deciding vote. Pushed by the administration of President George W. Bush, CAFTA-DR passed the House thanks to 15 Democrats who voted against their party lines. 27 Republican lawmakers and one independent voted against the pact. The trade agreement was hotly debated among both parties and represents a key victory for Bush, who risked considerable political capital in pressing for its approval. Well, I don't know what political capital he's risking, frankly. Well, I'll tell you what they're talking about here, I think. It's his negotiation with the entire hemisphere for the free trade area of the Americas. That's probably the political capital. Frankly, he's a lame duck president. He can't be reelected. Of course, I doubt presidents are really elected in this day and age anyway. We have three companies controlling most of the votes in America today, so do we really have honest elections? Three companies with software that they're running that they will not open to the public for scrutiny. And that's the big problem that we face today. Our elections are a sham, and most are completely oblivious to that fact. At any rate, signed more than a year ago, CAFTA-DR was approved by a 54-45 vote in the Senate on June 30th, and its passage in the House was uncertain until the last minute. Bush and his cabinet fought an uphill battle to have it approved. While CAFTA-DR is expected to have little impact on the U.S. economy, and bear in mind, only time will tell what kind of impact it's going to have. But the U.S. exports $15 billion worth of goods to Central America. The CAFTA document became the most controversial free trade agreement Congress debated in years. In a rare meeting behind closed doors, Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and U.S. Trade Representative Rob Portman spent more than 1 hour in Congress on Wednesday to press Republican lawmakers to fully support the trade pact. Isn't that interesting? They spent more than an hour, which leads us to our shadow government, federal mafia heads up. Because wouldn't you love to have been a bug on the wall in that meeting? I mean, what exactly was told to these people? That's the question I want to know. What kind of deals were made? What kind of promises were made if they voted for it? And what kind of threats were made if they voted against it? Were they threatened with being stripped from their staff? Having their staff taken away from them? Maybe they were threatened with not ever being allowed to sit on a committee. Or maybe they had their families threatened. Maybe they were made an offer that they can't refuse. Turning the page to the Associated Press here, it says, President Bush insisted that the small trade agreement with six Latin American nations would pay big dividends for security, stability, and freedom in the Western Hemisphere. After persistent lobbying by the White House, Congress finally agreed. It took personal visits from the president and vice president, along with strenuous arm twisting from Republican leaders before the House passed the Central American Free Trade Agreement early Thursday by a two-vote margin, 217 to 215. I find it very interesting that they say strenuous arm twisting. I just would love to know what kind of arm twisting they're talking about here. But they say the Senate approved CAFTA last month, 54-45, as most of you know, and it now goes to the president for his signature. And, of course, this is being hailed as a victory for the Bush administration, which had to fend off claims by critics that the pact would harm American workers. Gee, you think? The president said in a statement following the vote, quote, CAFTA helps ensure that free trade is fair trade. By lowering trade barriers to American goods in Central American markets to a level now enjoyed by their goods in the U.S., This agreement will level the playing field and help American workers, farmers, and small businesses. Level the playing field. Well, it's going to level the playing field, all right, but what it's going to do is it's going to implement Chapter 3 of Agenda 21. That's what it's designed to do. Level the playing field. We're talking socialism here. And it's not designed to help the American workers, farmers, and small businesses. It's designed to help the Central American countries and the multinational corporations, which are going to be sending their jobs over to those Central American countries. Now, this is just one of many trade agreements that have taken place under the radar of the media, because they don't report these things. See, it's not important enough to have all these small trade agreements out there in the public. But the Central American countries also join Australia, Chile, Singapore, Jordan, and Morocco in seeing free trade agreements approved during Bush's time in office. Now, how many of you heard about these things before you heard about them from me? That's the question. You see, this is reported from the Associated Press, but it's reported on the Internet. How many newspapers carry this stuff? Well, maybe people who read find out more information. But I haven't heard this in the broadcast media, and a lot of people don't take the time to sit down and read anymore. I don't know how much of this I'm going to share with you, because frankly, we've covered the Central American Free Trade Agreement in the past, and now there's one thing I do want to share with you, and that is some of Bush's pretzel logic. One argument that he used and that was being used was a national security argument. And this is laughable. It's unbelievable that they would even stoop to making this kind of statement. It says, Bush administration officials dispatched to sell the idea to reluctant lawmakers said the stakes went beyond a newly opened market in a region that bought about $15 billion worth of U.S. goods last year. They used a national security argument, saying that rejecting the deal would impoverish the region and undermine new and fragile democracies. Instability and poverty would drive people north and increase the flow of illegal immigrants to the United States. Can you believe that, folks? They're actually trying to make the statement that instability and poverty would drive people north and increase the flow of illegal immigrants into the United States. First of all, it's failed trade policies like NAFTA that have created the illegal immigration problem that we have today. Under NAFTA, our border is to be eliminated. And if they were really worried about these illegal immigrants, they would revoke NAFTA. Not only that, but we have our military out of this country. We have military bases being closed here and opened overseas. If they were really concerned about homeland security and about protecting the United States from invasion, then why don't they bring the military back home, let the world police itself, and put our military on our border and keep the bases open? The bottom line here, folks, these people don't have our best interest in mind. When you have an administration, and it's not just this administration, it's every administration, because they're all the same. But the point is, if you're a sane person, if you're sane, and you got the best interest of your country in mind as you rule in the office that the public supposedly has trusted you to, assuming you had honest elections in the first place, and you find a policy that you've tried in the past and it doesn't work. It clearly does not work. It's a huge train wreck of a policy. What are you going to do? Are you going to do more of it? Are you going to do it on a massive scale? Or are you going to forsake that policy, reverse that policy, and do something else? The bottom line is, they're not representing us. They're representing the UN. They're representing global governance. They're representing a one-world system, and that's what this is all about. Representative Jim Colby, a Republican from Arizona, said certainly CAFTA doesn't fix all the problems facing Central America, but increased integration, and see, that's what it's all about, folks, is integration. Increased integration can only add jobs and help alleviate poverty, reduce the flow of migration northward, and make the region more competitive in world markets. Once upon a time, ladies and gentlemen, the United States was competitive in world markets. We were the largest exporter in the world. And that's all changed since this whole UN system has come along, since this whole global, worldwide thing, this worldwide, what they call the global market or the global economy has come along. This is what has crippled the United States. We were competitive before all these reforms took place. Now we're the largest debtor country in the world. So they've created this problem, and now they're proposing the solution to it, which is the Hegelian dialectic again. The administration won over several Republicans by pledging to protect textiles from Central American imports, but some never warmed to the agreement. A few lawmakers from states that produce textiles and sugars continued to fear that new imports would wipe out industries in their districts. Democratic Representative Charlie Melancon, who said his family owed everything to 225 years of sugar production in his home state of Louisiana, said, quote, "I don't see any benefits for workers, for sugar people." He said, "We've given away textiles. We've given away steel. We've given away fruits and vegetables. Now let's go ahead and give away everything and be dependent on every other country for our food and our defense." I couldn't have said it any better myself. Our defense is being taken away from us as well, as our military is being used as the United Nations global peacekeeping force to police the world and to conquer every country that won't go along with the plan of world domination by the controllers. Now that's all the time I'm going to spend on CAFTA. Our attention has to turn in the future to the free trade area of the Americas, which this CAFTA document says right in the preamble. You don't have to read very far to find the real agenda. The preamble of the document says that these Central American countries and the Dominican Republic agree to, along with the United States, to work toward a free trade area of the Americas, to provide an impetus toward that direction. It's right there in the preamble of the document. Just put it in a search engine, look it up. You don't have to read very far. So that's what this is all about. It's about globalization. It's about creating the American, the Western Hemisphere answer to the European Union and the China situation, the Asian Union, which is being built as well. All right, moving along here, because there's other lies that are being perpetrated on us and at us on a daily basis. And the major lie right now, a major lie, there's so many, is global warming. And what they say is that we're causing it. Hugh W. Elsasser, who holds a PhD, he is an expert, he's a scientist. He writes an article called "What You Never Hear About Greenhouse Warming." And I'm going to share this with you tonight, folks, because we need to counter the lies of the controlled media, which I come across articles all the time, that repeatedly say scientists say that human beings are causing global warming, or that our emissions, that greenhouse gas emissions are heating up the earth. Variations of the wording, but it's all the same thing. It's all the same UN claptrap. And even the scientists who help work on some of this data for the United Nations disagree with it. That's the amazing thing. The United Nations takes what they say and edits it out. They change the wording of these scientists. Hugh W. Elsasser, PhD, writes, "We have observational data providing an estimate of global mean surface air temperature since about 1870. While these data indicate a global warming of 0.3 to 0.6 degrees Celsius, this is significantly less than climate models predict should have occurred not due to man's additions of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. In addition, most of the observed warming occurred before World War II, before the bulk of the greenhouse gases had been emitted. To argue that the model predicted warming has been obscured by a natural cooling cycle requires a natural cooling of more than 1 degree Celsius over the past few decades, a cooling larger than any observed before in the documented climate history of Europe, which extends at some stations into the 17th century. Climate models predict that greenhouse warming should increase with latitude and be greatest in polar latitudes in winter. Since 1957, when regular observations began in Antarctica, neither pole has shown significantly more warming than the tropics. Since the time of the dinosaurs, the Earth has cooled by about 10 degrees Celsius. About 3 million years ago, we entered the present ice age, marked by a series of glacial-interglacial cycles with a mean global temperature range estimated by 5 to 7 degrees Celsius. The last seven of these cycles exhibited a glacial period of 90,000 years of staged cooling, followed by a rapid warming back to an interglacial lasting 10,000 to 12,000 years. Now he says, we are currently in an interglacial called the Holocene, estimated to have begun 10,700 years ago. Thus, we are due to enter another 90,000 year period of glacial cooling at any time. Since this is our current state of knowledge, why do we not hear the argument that adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere to delay and thereby hopefully prevent the next glacial is just what man should be doing? Well, and of course the answer to that question is, it just doesn't fit the template of the agenda. During the Holocene, or the Holocene, temperature fluctuations of plus and minus 1 to 2 degrees Celsius have been inferred from various types of data. The warmest period, the climatic optimum, occurred about 6,000 years ago. Around 900 AD, the sea ice in the North Atlantic melted back and the Norsemen were able to colonize Iceland and Greenland. About 1350 AD, the ice returned, the Greenland colony perished, and the glaciers advanced over rent-paying farms and villages in Switzerland and Scandinavia. Thus, we have both historical and paleoclimatological data for the medieval climatic optimum warm period, circa 900 to 1350 AD, and the following Little Ice Age cold period, circa 1350 to 1850 AD. I hope you folks are following this. I know this is a lot of stuff to digest without seeing it on paper. The least controversial explanation for the warming shown by our surface temperature observations is that it represents a return to normal from the Little Ice Age period and possibly entry into the next warm period of the Holocene. If this is what is occurring, we are now at the inflection point, or point of most rapid rise of the temperature curve, and we can look forward to a further warming of about another degree Celsius over the next couple of centuries, regardless of what man does. Note also that the warm periods of the past have been termed climatic optima, and so they must have appeared to the remnants of the Greenland colony circa 1350 AD. The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change claim that, quote, the balance of evidence suggests as anthropogenic influence on global climate, unquote. That claim elicited much controversy. Its invalidity is now indicated by Richard Kerr and Klaus Hasselmann articles in the May 16, 1997 issue of Science. These contain statements like the following, quote, many climate experts caution that it is not at all clear yet that human activities have begun to warm the planet, or how bad greenhouse warming will be when it arrives. That was Richard Kerr, research, news, and comment writer for Science. Now, get this, folks. This is Benjamin D. Santer, lead author of Section 8 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, 1995, the IPCC 95. He said, quote, "We say quite clearly that few scientists would say the attribution issue was a done deal." Did you hear that? This is one of their own scientists from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And he said, "We say quite clearly that few scientists would say the attribution issue was a done deal." In other words, what is he talking about? The attribution issue. Attributing global warming to human causes. That's what he's talking about here. And he's saying that few scientists would say that the attribution issue was a done deal. In other words, very few scientists are going to conclude that we're causing global warming. That's what he's saying. Now, why aren't you hearing about that in the controlled media? That's the question that you need to be asking. And, of course, it's a rhetorical question because I think most of you know the answer. We got to take a break here, folks. We're going to continue this on the other side of the break because we have to confront the lies of the controllers. If we don't confront the lies of the controllers, if we leave them unabated and unchallenged, then they're going to have their way with us. They're going to shove their agenda of control down our throats, and we're not going to have a prayer. That's why we got to spread this information. And that's why we do what we do here, and that's why you're listening to First Amendment Radio Network. Stay listening. We're going to continue on the other side of the break. Don't go anywhere, folks.
Record budget deficit, bankruptcies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is Caesar's.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep in the pews. The scripture calls for his people to come out of her. The corporate church is the apostate church, the whore that rides the beast. Get this DVD for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Make copies and give them away to your corporate church friends and loved ones. The truth will make them free. They will watch the DVD, Government Takeover of the Church. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com or call 559-781-3773. Who will tell them if not you? If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
In this day of economic uncertainty and soaring unemployment, safe investments are often hard to find. But investing in the precious metals is the safest investment of all, because gold and silver is real money. Government-printed currency is not. Call Melody Cedarstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company at 1-800-375-4188. Melody has been helping people secure their financial future for over 10 years. While others in the business claim honesty, Melody will deliver. Give her a call. 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
Media. This is American Exposé radio broadcast on the First Amendment Radio Network. I'm Darren Weeks. Welcome back from the break, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to get back to this global warming thing here in just a moment, but first of all, I want to share with you a piece from the Associated Press real quick about the troops. Some of the stuff that's going on in Iraq and with the soldiers when they're coming home. They say that 30% of U.S. troops surveyed have developed stress-related mental health problems 3 to 4 months after coming home from the Iraq War, the Army's Surgeon General said on Thursday. The survey of 1,000 troops found problems including anxiety, depression, nightmares, anger, and inability to concentrate, said Lieutenant General General Kevin Kiley and other military medical officials. A smaller number of troops, often with more severe symptoms, were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, a serious mental illness. The 30% figure is in contrast to the 3 to 5% diagnosed with a significant mental health issue immediately after they leave the war theater, according to Colonel Elspeth Ritchie, a military psychiatrist on Kiley's staff. A study of troops who were still in the combat zone in 2004 found 13% experienced significant mental health problems. Soldiers departing a war zone are typically given a health evaluation before they leave combat, but the Army is now instituting a program for follow-up screenings 3 to 6 months later, said Kiley, speaking to reporters at a breakfast meeting. Screenings of 1,000 U.S. soldiers who returned from Iraq to their home bases in Italy last year found that 3 to 4 months later, 30% had some mental health difficulties, a much greater incidence than expected. Kiley attributed that to post-combat stress problems taking time to develop once the danger has passed. Only about 4% to 5% of troops coming home from combat actually have PTSD, but many others faced problems adjusting when they came home, Kiley said. Such problems are sometimes more acute in members of the National Guard who return to civilian jobs when they leave the military active duty, Ritchie said. Military medical officials, however, cautioned against people reading their data as suggesting that the war had driven so many soldiers over the edge. Instead, they characterized the anxiety and stress as normal reactions to combat, seeing dead and mutilated bodies and feeling helpless to stop a violent situation. And it goes on and on and on there. But the point is, what is the reason for this war that we have going on? There is no national interest. There is no sovereign interest that we have over there. Oil, you say? It's about oil? No, it's not. We have plenty of oil. We have plenty of oil if the U.S. government would just allow people, the oil companies, to develop it. We've been made dependent upon foreign oil for a reason and a purpose, and that purpose is so that we can meddle into the affairs of every country that won't go along with globalism. We're going to have to make a decision as parents that we're not going to let our children go over there. What if they had a war and nobody showed up? You can't have wars if you don't have people that are willing to die for what they believe is the country. They're not dying for the country, they're dying for the global order. As Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said, and we have this quote on the front page of sweetliberty.org, in defense of the world order, U.S. soldiers would have to kill and die. We're not going to have a world order without first paying for it with blood and words. Well, it's not going to be his blood, and it's not going to be the blood of his children. Also, from the New York Times, we're finding that Endangered Species Act is embroiled in court battles. And again, I'm going to get back to the global warming stuff here in just a moment. But I think this information is important. I want to throw it in here. Endangered Species Act embroiled in court battles. The law is facing more challenges than ever before. They say, more than three decades after the Endangered Species Act gave the federal government tools and a mandate to protect animals, insects, and plants threatened with extinction, the landmark law is facing the most intense efforts ever by the White House, members of Congress, landowners, and industry to limit its reach. Now, here again you have the Hegelian dialectic in play, because the White House is not really on the side of individual liberty and private property rights. That's very clear. But the phony neocons on radio and TV will point to this and say, look, they're good guys, when in reality there's no difference. They say that more than any time in the law's 32-year history, the obligations it imposes on government and indirectly on landowners are being challenged in the courts, reworked in the agencies responsible for enforcing it, and re-examined in Congress. In some cases, the challenges are broad and sweeping, as when the Bush administration, in a legal battle about the best way to protect endangered salmon, declared western dams to be as much a part of the landscape as the rivers they control. And the point is that we have dam removal going on today in a massive scale. Isn't it interesting that we have California, one of the most environmentally advanced states in the nation, and yet they've experienced the most power outages and brownouts and rolling blackouts? Could that be the future of the whole country? This New York Times piece says that there are currently 1,264 species that are considered threatened or endangered. 1,264, and God help you if you find one of those in your yard. Or God help you if they find one of those in your yard. Now, moving along here, I got one more thing, and then we'll go back to this global warming stuff, because it's important. William Judd writes in the Sierra Times about the ivory-billed woodpecker. The August-September 2005 reporter tip sheet from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service outlines the plan for recovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker, a bird believed extirpated from the United States for the past 59 years. So far, there is no solid evidence that the bird exists in Arkansas's Cache River Wildlife Area, where the claim of discovery was made. The 10 seconds of video showing a flying bird are not definitive and are coming under question. Even without solid evidence of the bird, planning and proposed federal spending are exploding. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, quote, a newly formed recovery team intends to have its plan for protecting the woodpecker ready by summer of 2007, unquote. The team's goal is to develop a full recovery program by summer of 2007, covering the bird's historic range. Get ready, you folks in these following states, because this is where they're targeting: Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Texas. At first, 5,000 acres of the Arkansas Cache River Wildlife Preserve were closed to the public use. Then 10,500,000 of federal money was made available for woodpecker recovery, and another $10 million is on the way. Now the plan is to set up woodpecker recovery throughout the bird's historic range, which covers those nine southeastern states. This gangrene and federal wildlife plan is following the same path as the infamous spotted owl. Yeah, you folks remember the spotted owl. Thousands of lives were destroyed over the spotted owl because they said it couldn't co-mingle with human habitat. Your human development was going to interfere with the spotted owl's mating habits and endanger the bird. That argument lasted until they found the spotted owl surviving quite nicely in a Kmart sign in Nevada. At any rate, this gangrene and federal wildlife plan is following the same path as the infamous spotted owl, the Indiana bat, the Colorado lynx, salmon, and a host of other plants and animals used under the expired Endangered Species Act to shut down rural communities, rural economies, and deny citizens their access and use of public land and even their own land. The woodpecker has not been seen in the United States for 59 years, which begs the question, haven't we gotten by just fine without it? I said that, he didn't. But it does live in Cuba. Did someone arrange to have a woodpecker captured in Cuba, smuggled into Arkansas, and released? He asks. That makes a lot more sense than the sudden resurrection of a dead bird which nobody has seen and which has left no evidence of its presence in a populated area for 59 years. The goal, as gangrene's track record amply shows, is unlikely to be wildlife protection and restoration. The traditional goal of this sort of activity is acquisition of land, money, and political power by gangrene environmentalists and federal wildlife agencies using the endangered bird as a vehicle for the project. Even if an ivory-billed woodpecker exists in Arkansas, there are far better uses for the money than woodpecker recovery. Cost of the recovery project is likely to be millions to tens of millions of dollars per bird. This woodpecker issue has every earmark of a gigantic con game to be financed with taxpayer money and from federal and state treasuries. The woodpecker matter needs to come under immediate federal investigation before it goes completely out of control, wastes hundreds of millions of dollars, and severely damages the culture, customs, and economy of nine southeastern states. Well, I don't know how much good a federal investigation is going to do. When the federal government controls what the federal government does, the fix is in. But speaking of con games, we're going to get back to this global warming situation because we're running out of time. Now, before the break, I was sharing with you some quotes from some experts writing in Science, the May 16, 1997 edition. He says, from these acknowledgments by its supporters, it seems quite clear that the IPCC 95 statement, the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate, was studiously crafted. The purpose of the wording appears to have been to induce the media to broadcast to the public and policymakers of the world a message which few, if any, of the researchers on whose work it was based are yet willing to defend before the scientific community. Global climate policy may reach a crescendo in Kyoto in December, and this is a little bit dated, but it will not be because of a compelling scientific case has been made that requires action to be taken to ward off environmental calamity. The theory of human-induced global warming is far from being an open-and-shut case. While the concept of greenhouse warming is well-established, its actuality on planet Earth currently rests only on the predictions of climate models. That the models still lack the desired precision is evident by their broad disagreement with each other and with observational data, such as their less-than-specific forecast of temperature history. Models of global warming are especially oversimplified for the tropics, due to their inability to cope with very low humidities in the down-dwelling portions of the Hadley circulation. Any surface warming in the tropics will lead to acceleration of downdrafts of convectively dried air, opening deeper and enlarged subtropical windows for infrared radiation to escape. As a result, model predictions of global warming in the tropics seem exaggerated by a factor of 2 to 3 times. Efforts to construct a fingerprint of man-made global warming have also done little to enhance the credibility of doom and gloom global warming forecasts. Even the IPCC was forced to conclude that, number one, It is not possible at this time to attribute all or even a large part of the observed global mean warming to enhanced greenhouse effects on the basis of observational data currently available. And the IPCC was forced to conclude, number two, we do not know what the detailed signal or fingerprint looks like because we have limited confidence in our predictions of climate change patterns. Now, this writer continues. He says, moreover, there is a consistent bias against good news. Now, why do you think that would be, folks? Why do you think there would be a consistent bias against good news? He says, very reputable scientists are engaged in global climate research, but their careful statements are either suppressed or ignored when they do not support dire scenarios. Interesting, isn't it? The United Nations, of course, has tremendous incentives to promote widespread dissemination of bad news. Global doom scenarios enhance its position as a transfer agent for massive flows of wealth from developed to developing nations. Until global climate change models improve significantly, we do not know whether we have a serious threat to our planet, no threat, or even a beneficial outcome due to man-made greenhouse gas emissions. In short, despite pronouncements by political leaders in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere, policymakers are not being compelled to act on the basis of global warming science. Indeed, global warming science is still evolving. They need the crisis. Ordo ab chao. Out of the chaos is where they get their order. Now, something else from Sovereignty.net, Henry Lamb's organization. Are people really causing climate change? It says, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, says, quote, the balance of evidence suggests human influence on global climate, unquote. After 10 years and millions of dollars spent on research, this is the strongest statement, and of course the key word is suggests. The balance of evidence suggests human influence on global climate. They say, after 10 years and millions of dollars of research spent, this is the strongest statement that the UN has made. This statement appears in a 7-page executive summary prepared by policymakers of a 2,000-page IPCC report. Chapter 8 of the scientists' report was heavily edited by the policymakers to remove several statements by scientists who were skeptical of a human influence on global climate. It is widely known that global climate changes in historical cycles for reasons that science has not yet been able to explain. Greenland was green when the Vikings discovered it during what scientists call the global optimum. Then the planet began to cool. Between about 1250 and 1850, the planet endured a cooling period that turned Greenland white with snow and ice. Human production of carbon dioxide did not cause that global climate change. For about 100 years after 1850, global temperatures began to rise. In 1896, a Swedish scientist discovered that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was increasing. There is no debate in the scientific community that carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere has increased from about 270 parts per million at the beginning of the century to about 350 parts per million at the end of the century. In the 1970s, Dr. Steven Schneider and a few other scientists predicted that the increase of carbon dioxide would cause a new ice age, a period of global cooling. Their fears, however, were not supported by the actual temperature data collected from ground and ocean weather stations. The actual global temperature remained relatively static. An argument was advanced that said that the reason the ground measuring stations were not reporting global cooling was due to the urban sink effect. Now, the urban sink effect is, weather stations usually located at airports and near cities were said to be reporting temperatures distorted by the heat buildup in pavement and concrete buildings around the weather stations. So to overcome this problem, the United States launched weather satellites in 1979 to measure temperatures from the Earth's surface through the troposphere. The satellite data clearly demonstrates that the actual global temperature has declined slightly since 1979, which is statistically insignificant. Why then do the United Nations and the U.S. government insist that human-induced global warming is occurring. The speculation that increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will cause global warming is the result of projections based on computer models. The first projections released just before the Climate Change Treaty was presented predicted very rapid increases in global temperature as much as 8.5 degrees by 2050. Those projections created an atmosphere of urgency at the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, the Earth Summit that gave us Agenda 21, and the treaty was quickly ratified by nearly every nation. Since then, the modelers have produced two downward revisions of their projected global warming. The most recent prediction is an increase of between 1 and 2.5 degrees by the year 2100. Many of the modelers say publicly that it will be several years before their computers will be able to make reliable predictions. The policymakers have seized the statement of the IPCC executive summary as the justification necessary to implement a protocol to the original climate change treaty that will impose legally binding requirements that 34 developed nations reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, while 137 nations, China, Mexico, Brazil, Korea, and others, are not required to reduce their emissions at all. The science is no longer debated at the UN or at the White House. The science issue is closed as far as the policymakers are concerned, but climate scientists feel differently. In 1995, a group of climatologists, astrophysicists, and meteorologists assembled in Leipzig, Germany, to discuss climate change. These are the scientists, ladies and gentlemen. These are the people who know what they're talking about. Don't listen to me. Listen to them. The declaration says, quote, "The policies to implement the treaty are, as of now, based solely on unproven scientific theories, imperfect computer models, and unsupported assumptions. Actual observations from weather satellites show no global warming whatsoever." Unquote. So what they're saying here is not only are human beings, there's no proof, no scientific proof that human beings are causing it, but there's really no proof that it's even going on in the first place. And yet, this fact, the reality, is lost upon the policymakers that are trying to cram this down our throat. The document has now been signed by most of the world's climatologists. Did you know that, folks? If not, why not? Why aren't you being told? The questions that every person should ask are, number one, why is the international community insisting that 34 developed nations reduce their fossil fuel consumption while allowing the rest of the world to expand their use of fossil fuel? And number two, why is the White House promoting this policy? Now, in the waning moments of the broadcast, I want to read to you from the actual declaration, the Leipzig Declaration. These are the scientists, and as this other piece from Sovereignty International said, most of the world's climatologists have signed this declaration. These are the people with the credentials. They say, as independent scientists researching atmospheric and climate problems, we, along with many of our fellow citizens, are apprehensive about the climate treaty conference scheduled for Kyoto, Japan, in December of 1997. This gathering of politicians from some 160 signatory nations aims to impose on citizens of the industrialized nations, but not on others, a system of global environmental regulations that include quotas and punitive taxes on energy fuels. Fossil fuels provide today's principal energy source, and energy is essential for all economic growth. Stabilizing atmospheric carbon dioxide, the announced goal of the climate treaty, would require fuel use to be cut by as much as 60 to 80% worldwide. Did you hear that? 60 to 80% worldwide, ladies and gentlemen. What is that going to do to your economy? What is that going to do with your ability to produce wealth? In a world in which poverty is the greatest social pollutant, any restriction on energy use that inhibits economic growth should be viewed with caution. We understand the motivation to eliminate what are perceived to be the driving forces behind a potential climate change, but we believe that emerging Kyoto Protocol, to curtail carbon dioxide emissions from only part of the world community is dangerously simplistic, quite ineffective, and economically destructive jobs to jobs and standards of living. More to the point, we consider the scientific basis of the 1992 Global Climate Treaty to be flawed and its goal to be unrealistic. The policies to implement the treaty are, as of now, based solely on unproven scientific theories, imperfect computer models, and unsupported assumptions that catastrophic global warming follows from the burning of fossil fuels and requires immediate action. They say, we do not agree. We believe that the dire predictions of a future warming have not been validated by the existing climate record. These predictions are based on nothing more than theoretical models and cannot be relied on. As the debate unfolds, it becomes increasingly clear that, contrary to the conventional wisdom, there does not exist today a general scientific consensus about the importance of greenhouse warming from rising levels of carbon dioxide. In fact, many climate specialists now agree that actual observations from weather satellites show no global warming whatsoever, in direct contradiction to computer model results. Historically, climate has always been a factor in human affairs, with warmer periods such as the medieval climate optimum playing an important role in economic expansion and in the welfare of nations that depend primarily on agriculture. Colder periods have caused crop failures and led to famines, disease, and other documented human misery. We, of course, remain sensitive to any and all human activities that could affect future climate. However, based on all evidence available to us, we cannot subscribe to the politically inspired worldview that envisages climate catastrophes and calls for hasty actions. For this reason, we consider the drastic emission control policies likely to be endorsed by the Kyoto Conference lacking credible support from the underlying science to be ill-advised and premature. Right from the scientist's mouth, signed by most of the scientists of the world, most of the climatologists of the world, the people that know what they're talking about. Global warming? Yet, to heck with the science, full speed ahead with the agenda. We gotta go, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being with us this week. Do what you can to restore this republic. Pray for it. God bless you, and have a good weekend. Thank you.